the Apostle John while he is exiled on the island of Patmos. It comes, if our dating is correct, during the last part of the first century and during the first worldwide persecution of Christians under the Emperor Domitian. Under the second persecution, the first being under Nero, which was rather limited to Rome, and the persecution under Domitian was more widespread. He's exiled on the island of Patmos, and the Lord reveals to him the things that play out in the book of Revelation. The first portion of it addresses some very detailed, short little epistles that are sent to seven churches that are not far from the island of Patmos, that we know as the seven churches of Asia. Asia not in the sense of China and India, Asia in the sense of that region of modern-day Turkey that's usually referred to as Asia Minor. That leads into, immediately after those things, a vision that is revealed to John of a scene, the throne room scene in heaven. And there are a number of things that are revealed there where, as the throne is displayed and all of the wonders of that, we have a few elements that will be recurring throughout this book. Anytime there are some things that are seen in the throne room of heaven or in the throne vision of heaven, you'll have reference to 24 elders. And our best guess about that is that by referring to the 24 elders, you are taking the 12 tribes or the 12 patriarchs, and you're taking the 12 apostles and combining them into one. And we've seen several times in which that seems to play out. There's reference to four living creatures. And our best guess with that, if you look at the creatures as they are described, they seem to match some things that we can conclude about the various tribes around the tabernacle when the children of Israel came out into the wilderness. There where you have one of a man, one of an eagle, etc., where you'll have these four. If you tie several things together, it seems to be a similar vision to what you see in the book of Ezekiel, and which seems to simply be a way of describing God's people around the throne of God. Outside of that, then, are the angels. Now, after that, there are a number of visions that are revealed to the Apostle John, many of which are connected to the number seven. There'll be seven trumpets that are blown. There's seven seals that are open. And often what you see in this is kind of a cycle of a description of hardship or persecution that then culminates in restoration, culminates in God delivering His people. Now, we've made some observations about the book of Revelation that I think prove to be very valuable to us as we try to understand the things that are revealed. We went back and spent some time looking at the way God has communicated some things prophetically in the past. We looked at some dreams that God had revealed to Joseph. We looked at some dreams that God had revealed to Pharaoh. Many of you who were in this class before the Revelation class, when we looked at Daniel, you will remember that there are a number of things that are revealed to Daniel in which there'll be a dream in which there's an image. You'll remember that image of four different types that represent four different kingdoms. And there's another vision that's in the book of Daniel that will become important to us in chapter 13 tonight, in which there are four different beasts that are described. And we'll go back to that in a little bit. But one of the reasons that I think it's important to kind of go back and think about the way God's communicated in the past is because if you look at the book of Revelation and you see it simply as describing that there will literally be this beast or that beast that will come, there will literally be these creatures that look like locusts, it will give you a great deal of difficulty because you will be looking for almost kind of a science fiction sort of fulfillment of these kinds of things. If, on the other hand, you understand that God has often communicated to His people things that will happen by describing cows that eat other cows, as in the dreams that Pharaoh would have, as in sheaves bowing down and worshiping, as in the dream that Joseph had, you don't have quite as much trouble, because I think we see a number of things in the book of Revelation that are very similar to that. Now, one other thing that I want to mention before we actually get into the text in chapter 13 is the fact that if we are correct in placing the book of Revelation during this time of major persecution against Christians, what you have is you have John, an exiled apostle, perhaps by this time the only remaining living apostle, who is put in a position where he's removed from his brethren. He's put in a position where it may be that some of these things will make it to his brethren. Hopefully these seven epistles that are a part of the book of Revelation would be able to go to the churches. But he is under the hand of Roman oppressors. And as a result, when the beginning of the book indicates to us that it describes these things that must shortly come to pass, it describes things that he signifies to his apostles, signifies to John the things that must shortly come to pass. What we see is a number of times, I believe, John will utilize terminology, or the Holy Spirit leads John to utilize terminology, that would have engendered certain images in the minds of Christians. Things like reference to Babylon. If you had been a Christian, if you had been particularly a Christian from a Jewish background, you would have known fully well that the history of God's people leading up to what Babylon had done, Babylon was the nation that destroyed the temple. Babylon was the nation that took the Jews into exile. So, while in the first century, Babylon's not really a power to be reckoned with, if you, in the first century, speak to your Christian brethren about Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots, the city that rules over the kings of the earth, that's a way you can communicate to your brethren Rome without saying Rome, so that your oppressors will come down upon you even more firmly. We see that a number of times. And I've likened it to, and one of these days I might try to put together an article or something utilizing this as an illustration. If we took our songbooks and we took some phrases that are common phrases in our songbooks and we tried to tell the gospel story by just some of those phrases, you know, if we made reference to the old rugged cross or we made reference to other songs, we would instantly know certain things in connection with those songs. I think many things in the book of Revelation are exactly like that. Do you remember when we looked in the last couple of chapters, chapter 11 and chapter 12? And one of these chapters, for example, remember there was reference to two witnesses. And you look at that initially, and it talks about these two witnesses that are killed and then resurrected. Now, our denominational friends will look at that and try to say, all right, there's going to literally be two people that one of these days will be killed and resurrected. But if you look carefully at what is said about that, it describes these two by making reference to one that can shut up the heavens so that it won't rain, another that can turn the water into blood. And we ask ourselves when we looked at that, what do you think of when you hear water turning to blood? You think of Moses. What do you think of when you hear the heavens being shut up? You think of Elijah. And if you compare that kind of to Jesus being transfigured, with Moses and Elijah representing the law and the prophets, they're speaking to him. I'm more inclined to think that when it makes reference to those two witnesses, it's not talking about two literal human beings that will live, but it's talking about the law and the prophets that may have been viewed by the enemy, viewed by the persecutor as having been killed, but they were resurrected and caught back up in heaven. And the fact that all of those things that the law and prophets had pointed to were in fact fulfilled. And there were other things that we saw last week, or last time we looked at chapter 12. There was a very unusual example of this where you have this woman that gives birth to a child that will rule the nations with a rod of iron. And we made reference to a psalm that makes that very reference to what the Messiah would do. And that seems to be a pretty clear indication that it's talking about Christ as the one that rules the nations with the rod of iron. But it doesn't seem to be talking about this woman in terms of the mother of Jesus, Mary. Instead, it seems to be using that much more broadly. And you'll remember it makes reference to the 12 stars upon her head. And the conclusion that I think we reached as we were talking about that is it's a representation of the spiritual Israel, or the what is fulfilled now in the church. So it's the idea of the spiritual Israel bringing forth the Messiah, but the beast persecuting the offspring of the woman. Christ was an offspring of the spiritual Israel, but those who are the rest of her offspring, which are those of us who are disciples of Christ, those of us who are a part of the spiritual Israel, The last part of chapter 12 talked about this beast, this dragon, persecuting the offspring of the woman as well. Now, I've said an awful lot here to kind of lead into chapter 13, so that hopefully chapter 13, it won't seem quite as mysterious to us as we look at it. Now, I want to give you a heads up right before we even read it. There are going to be things that we're going to spend some time with back in the book of Daniel that perfectly parallel Revelation chapter 13. We won't have time tonight to go into great detail in Daniel chapter 7. I urge you on your own, read chapter 13 carefully. Read it in detail. Go back and open your Bibles and read Daniel chapter 7 and read it in detail. I'm going to put a few things on the board that will kind of show where some of these mesh, but I think you'll find it very valuable if you do that. All right, could I get someone to read for us, please, for seven verses of Revelation chapter 13? For seven verses of Revelation chapter 13. Okay.
Then I stood on the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rising up out of the sea, having seven heads and ten horns, and on his horns ten crowns, and on his heads a blasphemous name. Now the beast which I saw was like a leopard. His feet were like the feet of a bear, and his mouth like a mouth of a lion. And the dragon gave him his power, his throne, and great authority. I saw one of his heads as if it had been mortally wounded, and his deadly wound was healed. And all the world marveled and followed the beast. So they worshipped the dragon and gave authority to the beast, and they worshipped the beast, saying, "Who is like the beast, who is able to make war with him?" And he was given a mouth speaking great things and blasphemy. And he was given authority to continue for 42 months. Then he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God, to blaspheme his name, his tabernacle, and those who dwell in heaven. It was granted to him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. And authority was given him over every tribe, tongue, and nation.
Okay. Someone else take for us, please, verse 8 down to about verse 15. Verse 8 to verse 15. Volunteer for that?
All who dwell on earth will worship him, which has not been written in the book of life, the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. If anyone has an ear, let him hear. He who leads into captivity shall go into captivity. He who kills with the sword must be killed with the sword. Here is the patience and faith of the saints. I saw another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb and spoke like a dragon. And he exercised all authority of the first beast presence and causes the earth and those who dwell in it to worship the first beast, whose deadly wound is healed. He performs great signs so that he even makes the fire come down from heaven on earth in the sight of men. And he deceives those who dwell on the earth by those signs which he was granted to do in the sight of the beast, telling those who dwell on the earth to make an image to the beast who was wounded by the sword and lived. He was granted power to give breath to the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause as many as would not worship the image of the beast to be killed.
Okay. And would someone take us from 16 down to the end of the chapter, please? 16 to the end of the chapter. Sure.
And he caused us to say, both small and great, rich and poor, free and bond, to receive a mark in their right hand or in their forehead, that no man might buy or sell, save he that had the mark, or the name of the beast, or the number of his name. Here is wisdom. Let him that hath understanding count the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man. His number is 666.
Okay. Now, we have talked, as we've studied the book of Revelation, about the fact that often the book of Revelation has been viewed as looking ahead into the distant future. Now, we have tried to make the point that if you look in the context of the things that are said, as well as the way the book begins by saying this describes things that must shortly come to pass, a pretty good argument, I think, can be made that what we're dealing with is not the distant future, 2,000 years from the time that it was written, but some of those things that would happen in the centuries after the New Testament, or some of those things that even describe what was taking place in the persecution that they were experiencing then. Now, so far as we've looked, we've seen a number of things that seem to not point to some future kind of oppressor, but rather to just describe those things that Rome was doing to them and give assurance to those that were enduring this persecution of the fact that there'll be deliverance. There'll be a time when that'll be over. And even if your life is forfeit in this life due to persecution, ultimately you'll be victorious in the age to come. Now, in the last couple of chapters, you'll remember back when we looked at the statement where it described measuring of the temple and the courtyard being given to the Gentiles to trample it underfoot for 42 months. It's pretty clear in some of those things that what it's describing is the kind of thing that would happen when Rome would come in and would do just like Babylon had done. Rome would destroy the temple. Rome would conquer Jerusalem. And so Rome becomes that same sort of figure. If our dating is right, that's already happened by the time the book of Revelation is written. So Christians that hear such images would understand that pretty clearly. The same thing is true back in chapter 12 when it makes reference to this woman giving birth to a son that shall rule the nations with a rod of iron and the dragon making war against her offspring. That becomes very important. If we're talking about a period where the Emperor Domitian is persecuting Christians while this book is being written, that's going to not ring to the ears of John and other Christians to some far-off future. It will resonate with them to describe those things that are happening in the present. Now, in the same way, I think chapter 13 here points to many things that can be understood that same way. Now, I think that's true just in the context of what we read. But if you go back and look at Daniel chapter 7, then I think it makes it absolutely clear. Turn your Bibles back to Daniel chapter 7. I wish that we had the time to go through and to read all of Daniel chapter 7, but I'm afraid we just wouldn't have time to do that tonight. What I do want to do, though, if you were in our class when we had the Daniel class, we spent a good deal of time on chapter 7 talking about some things that you can see within this chapter. They're very powerful, and we made the observation that in Daniel chapter 7, it has a little bit of a parallel that goes back to one of the visions that you'll see. It's not going to cooperate. We'll just do it this way. That you see from early on in the book. Remember back in chapter 2, this image that Nebuchadnezzar sees, which represents these four kingdoms. And this seems to be echoed in something that is seen in chapter 7, because in chapter 7, what you see are four beasts. Now, the reason this is very significant, what did we just notice in Daniel chapter 13, or in Revelation chapter 13? This beast that is seen, did you catch the way that it is described? Daniel 7 describes it as four beasts, Revelation chapter 13 just speaks of it as one beast, but what's similar about it? It's kind of obvious with what I'm putting up here, but what's similar about it?
Four parts.
Four parts are exactly the same. Here where you have, instead of four beasts, you have one beast that has a part that's a lion, a part that's a bear, a part that's a leopard, and then ten horns. Now, if you're a Christian, particularly a Christian from a Jewish background, and you've understood some things about the book of Daniel, you're going to see this and you're going to go, that's the same. That's the same thing. And as Christians, if we would spend a good deal of time with these, I think the same sort of thing would resonate with us. Now, what's significant about that? Well, as it goes on to talk about this, these four beasts, it seems to be drawing a connection with these kingdoms. And the interpretation that's given seems to be pretty clear. The horns that are in both chapter 13 of Revelation and in chapter 7 of Daniel, we had made the point that if you look at the history, there are different ways that you can look at this that seem to have a connection to the Roman emperors. And there are a few different ways that you can calculate this depending upon if you want to count a few kings together or which king you want to start with. And what's significant about this is if you look at these beasts that are described in Daniel chapter 7, you'll remember back from our Daniel study, Rome did not have kings for a long time. In fact, they had been opposed to the idea of having kings for a long time. And it's not until you have Julius Caesar Augustus, depending on how you want to count it, that that's even tolerated. So you start with these, and depending on how you want to count it, it'll lead up to these numbers. And some interesting things about these characters, you'll find that of leading up here to Domitian, you've got in Vespasian, Titus, and Domitian, father and two sons. Of these, one conquered Judea, one destroyed the temple, and one that persecuted Christians. Now, a few things that are said in Daniel chapter 7 about this little horn speaking pompous words. We offered this quote that's given by a Roman historian about Domitian, that he insisted that people refer to him as our Lord God. That's a pretty pompous way of insisting that people refer to you. Also in Daniel chapter 7, it speaks of making war against the saints. The very language that Revelation chapter 13 will use in describing what is done. The authority comes from the beast or from the dragon, but it speaks of making war against the saints. And it seems pretty clear that if this is leading up to Domitian as this character, he's the first that began this worldwide persecution of Christians. And you'll notice there that we actually went and looked at chapter 13 of Revelation back when we were looking in Daniel chapter 7. Now, let me offer just to you one last thing here that may kind of put some of this in perspective. If you're talking about these ten horns, one of the things that's pointed out in Revelation chapter 13 is there's one that seemed as if it had been mortally slain. We'll come back to that in just a moment. The numbers here, you could start with Julius, and you'd get your ten coming down to Domitian. If you consider the fact that those I have listed under seven here, it's difficult to really count these as three separate ones, because within 1 year, you had a real period of turmoil after the death of Nero with these three. So you can count them as three, and that brings your numbers a little different. But if you count them together as one, that would put Domitian as ten. Or another possibility could be, if you're looking here at father, son, and father and two sons, that you just consider those three together as the Flavian dynasty and what they did. And one of the reasons that I think that it's kind of interesting that chapter 13 will speak of a horn that looked as if it had been mortally slain, but yet it lived. If you're a Christian that lived in the late part of the first century, you would know well that Nero had been one who had persecuted Christians. It's probably the case that the Apostle Paul died under the persecution of Nero. It's probably the case that the Apostle Peter died under the persecution of Nero. And yet Nero had been killed by his own people. If memory serves, I think some of the Praetorian Guard had actually killed him. Now, if that's the case, you've got this persecutor that was killed. But just right on his heels, after you have these three that didn't really do very much, three in 1 year, then you have these three that come to power. Again, one that conquered Judea, one that destroyed the temple, and the last, Domitian, that persecuted Christians. So however you want to count this with the ten, I think that becomes very important to see these connections here. Now, I've said an awful lot. Thoughts or comments or questions about the things that are said in Daniel chapter 7 and their relationship to Revelation chapter 13. All right, go back then to Revelation chapter 13, and let's just make a couple of observations here. Notice the very same things that are described back in Daniel chapter 7, where you have the four beasts here. It describes this beast as coming up out of the sea, having seven heads and ten horns, and on his horns ten crowns, and on his head a blasphemous name. Notice it describes in verse 2 these same four kinds of things. It describes the ten horns, it describes a bear, describes a leopard, and all of these things that are connected with this. Notice what verse 2 says, though. Where does the power come from? The dragon. And one thing that the book of Daniel doesn't really do, that the book of Revelation really brings out, is the fact that these different powers that exalt themselves against God and against His people, at the heart of any evil always rests the master of evil, or always rests the author of evil. When we do those things that are against God, We're not serving the will of God, we're serving the will of Satan. And so I think here when Revelation points out that it's the dragon that gives them authority, it's not saying God that Satan has power that God doesn't grant him or that he has power over God, no. But it's just describing, I think, the fact that here you've got a persecutor of God's people, and that persecutor is following the will of the dragon, following the will of Satan. Thoughts or comments or questions down through verse 2? I believe so. I think you compare that to some of the things that are said back in chapter 12. And I think that seems to make pretty good sense there, because it'll describe, in fact, I think if you look verse 12 of chapter 12, there it will speak of, using parallel terminology, dragon, but there it'll speak of him as the devil. The devil has come down to you. And then verse 13 will switch and refer to it as the dragon. Any other thoughts or comments? I don't know. It may just be kind of a similar sort of reference to what was said back in Daniel about speaking pompous words. I'm inclined to think that that's the case. Now, one thing that I do know that was true among Christians in the first century is when you would have an emperor that would be particularly ominous in his persecution of Christians, their very name would become something that would be viewed with contempt. In fact, Domitian, it's very difficult to find any inscriptions that bear his name, because after his death, Christians defaced them because they hated him. You know, imagine if you had one that had killed your people, killed your brethren, you would view that name with contempt. Now, whether it's something like that or it is referring to the kind of pompous, blasphemous kinds of things that would come forth from this beast, I think there may be some question. Chuck?
Like you were saying, the pompous possibly becomes
himself
Lord God.
Right. What a blasphemous name. Right. That's right. And you know, that's an interesting thing, because many of the emperors, even before the arrogance of Domitian, would refer to themselves as the divine such and such. And so there is that hint of that. Now, part of that is tied into kind of Roman false religion, because the Romans believed that when someone died, then it was appropriate to worship their, they called it their noumen. But what's different about some of the later emperors is they insisted on people worshiping them as divine even while they were still alive. And so that becomes a different sort of thing. And it may be just something kind of like that, that this beast is treating itself as divine. And certainly Rome began to do that, because Rome would, particularly in the later stages of the first century, insist. Now, it didn't. Within the city of Rome, you had the Romans themselves that didn't like much the idea of worshiping one of their own. But in the provinces, you would have those that would promote emperor worship to the point that if you didn't worship the emperor, you didn't burn incense to the emperor, you'd be killed. You'd be put to death. And I think that's exactly what some of the things here in chapter 13 are talking about. Any other thoughts or comments? All right. Notice verse 4. So they worshiped the dragon and gave authority to the beast. They worshiped the beast, saying, "Who is like the beast? Who is able to make war with him?" Again, you're a Christian in the first century. Is there any power, any earthly power, that's able to withstand Rome? There are a few that try, but none are very successful. And I think if you're a Christian in the first century, just like we'll see later on in the book where it speaks of the city that rules over the kingdoms of the earth, you'll know who it's talking about. Here, I think you'll know the same sort of thing. And verse 5 makes reference to something that is, this is not the first time that we've seen it, where it describes continuing for 42 months. This is perhaps the fourth reference to that, if we calculate some things correctly. Remember what some of the others were? We made reference to one of them back in chapter 11, when it described that outer court of the temple that had been given to the Gentiles to trample underfoot for 42 months. Then when it describes some things about the persecution of the offspring of the woman, as well as in chapter 11 as well, where it describes the power that the Gentiles would have. It doesn't use the term 42 months, but it uses the number 1,260 days. And it didn't occur to me until Brother Ledbetter, Brother Patrick Ledbetter, had asked the question if these two numbers were the same. Now, by the way we figure months, they would not be. But if you average a month to 30 days, that's exactly what you come up with. 42 days is exactly the same as that. Now, what's the significance of that? You'll hear some different things about that, but I think the main point seems to be this is a limited period of time. This is, you could calculate it in terms of some of the 70 or 7 numbers that we've looked at, and it kind of puts it within the 6th period leading to the 7th. So this is a limited period. During the 6th period of this, there'll be persecution. During this limited period, there'll be hardship, but it leaves open that 7th in which there'll be deliverance. And I think that's probably the way to understand this.
There's always a
7th day coming. That's right. And that may offer to us some significance when we get to verse 18 as well with this number, but we'll hold off on that for just a moment. Notice verse 7 uses the same terminology that Daniel chapter 7 used in reference to the things that Domitian would do. Now, I'm pretty conclusive in saying that I think Daniel chapter 7 was pointing ahead to what Domitian would do. Because you look at four kingdoms, Rome being the fourth. You look at these 10 kings. And however you want to count it, Domitian's the one that makes war against the saints. And he uses the same terminology. He's the one that speaks the pompous words. He's the one that has the blasphemous name to some extent or another. So here you have the same kind of terminology, making war against the saints. Notice, though, there's reference here to this second beast that comes up out of the earth. Now, I want you to notice that while this doesn't seem to have a perfect kind of parallel to what Daniel 7 told us about, what does it tell us about this second beast? What does it try to force or enforce? Notice down about verse 11, 12, 13. As the authority of the first beast, what does it try to urge people to do?
Worship the first one.
Now, I think that, while there may be some question about how to understand that, there was a cult of enforcement that went out into the provinces that insisted that the people worship the emperor. And I'm inclined to think that while the first beast that combines into it these different images of Daniel chapter 7, well, I'm inclined to think that that's talking about Rome and the emperors and all the evil that they did in connection with that. The second beast is probably just a way of describing the cult that enforced the worship of the emperor. You know, think about this. And we are... In some ways, we can't relate to this very much because we live in an age in which we can worship freely. We live in an age in which no one tells us what to believe. But you're a Christian in the first century. If you're unwilling to burn incense to the emperor, if you're unwilling to refer to him as divinity, you could lose your life. You could die for that. Now, I think if we think about that and we understand that's the period of time that this book is written in. You're a Christian and you read about this beast that forces all to bow down and worship the other beast. This beast that tries to, you know, it's interesting. If we're correct that this idea of the horn that had been mortally slain but came back to life, you know, if we're correct in thinking of that as well, Nero is the first persecutor. And then Domitian or the Flavian family as the second persecutor that's kind of come back to life. Very interesting thing. The monument that is in the city of Rome, it's called the Colosseum. Anybody know why it's called the Colosseum? The reason is because it was very near a colossal statue of Nero that was built in the city of Rome. It may be that it was no longer standing when Vespasian built the Colosseum. But here it talks about this image of the beast and making it as if it came to life and trying to make it as if it had all of these kinds of powers. You can really think of what it must have been like to be a Christian in Rome in the days of the Roman Empire, in which you've got those that are trying to say, you worship the emperor. He's the one that is your God, not this God of the Jews. You worship the emperor. And all of these things that are said here, I think, would just mesh so perfectly with what you're having to experience. Thoughts or comments or questions down through any of this? Now, you know, you don't have to go very far or listen to too many radio programs to hear an awful lot of people that will try to look at chapter 13, particularly as it will talk about some of these things. Verse 16, causing both small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on their right hand or on their forehead. You'll hear people that will talk about that being some sort of little microchip or something that will be put in your forehead or something like that. I don't see within the context of this anything that would lead us to think that this needs to be understood in that way. Now, one of the things that I think is rather interesting, verse 18, where it makes reference to this number of the beast, 666. Now, in spite of what all of the scary movies out there try to make you think, and in spite of what all of the denominationalists that view this as some future Antichrist figure that will come, I think there are some much easier explanations to this. The most simple is just thinking about it in terms of what we've already seen with our sixes and sevens. Six is the period of persecution, but it always is followed by seven, in which God delivers people. If you think of this as one who here is being pompous and arrogant and trying to insist that people would worship him, he can repeat that number six all he wants to, but it's never seven. Now, another explanation of this that I think is rather interesting, but I don't know. There's some question about how well this would have been understood by New Testament Christians. In both Greek and in Hebrew, they would associate numbers with certain letters of the alphabet. Now, if you spell out the name Caesar Neron, Caesar Nero, if you break that down in terms of the way that it is spelled in connection with the letters and the numbers, if you transliterate that with Hebrew letters, you come up with 666. Now, that may be a little bit tenuous, because would Christians in the first century in Asia Minor understand using Hebrew letters to put this to? Now, if that's something that they, you know, were expecting that they would understand Babylon as referring to Rome, it may well be that the same sort of thing was happening. But either way, I think it's pretty clear from context that you're not looking at something in which somebody's going to have a 666 tattoo on the back of their head. I don't think it's something like that. Instead, I think this is a way of referring to the one that may exalt himself, that may try to insist on people worshiping him, may be like a resurrected Nero in the form of Domitian, but he's not ever going to really accomplish anything. Because just as we've seen throughout the book, ultimately the Lamb who is slain from the foundation of the earth will be victorious. Those that don't worship the beast, they will ultimately be victorious. Thoughts, comments, or questions on chapter 13? Chuck?
Causes all, both small, great, rich, and poor, free, and bond, receive a mark. I've always thought of that as you receive the mark as one who does not burn incense to Caesar. It's not a physical. You're marked as one that does not do that. And then on the 666,
There are some that will suggest that in connection with emperor worship, there were some markings from time to time that might indicate, yes, this person has fulfilled their duty to worship the emperor, and so they can do that. But it may be, just as you say, that it's not that it's something that is just a distinction. The Christian didn't do that. The Christian didn't accept that was forced upon them. Even though they might forfeit their life for it, they recognize who they truly should fear. Final thought, comment, or question? All right, we'll pick up chapter 14 next week. Thank you for your thoughts.